So yeah, this is work in progress with a couple people at UBC, Felix Hale, Jason Pollock, Mark Van Ransdonk, and with Anthony here, with people working in kind of different combinatorics on different parts of it. I really do want to emphasize work in progress. This is going to be a little punchline light. I apologize a little bit for that. It is definitely an entanglement talk, which means it starts in the same place almost every entanglement talk in ADS-CFT starts, which is with our friendly Ryutaki and Nagi conjecture. So if we have the typical CFT cylinder with ADS on the inside, the Ryutaki and Nagi conjecture says that if I pick a region of on a time slice of the CFT, if I pick a region B, then its density matrix, or the entanglement entropy of the density matrix associated with B, is equal to, in the bulk, a kind of the expectation value of the area term on this B tilde, over 4G, where B tilde is the surface that, well, I'll write the rest of it first, plus the entanglement entropy of the bulk region density matrix on sigma, where sigma is this part of the bulk that's bounded by B and B tilde. B tilde is defined as the surface in the bulk that is homologous to B that minimizes this entire right side. This can be thought of, I guess, as a result of what might be the single strongest statement you can make in ADS-CFT of subregion-subregion duality. The idea that the microscopic degrees of freedom on B really are the kind of the same microscopic degrees of freedom that live on sigma up to maybe some ambiguities at the surface B tilde. And if I define the modular Hamiltonian as the logarithm of rho, such that, just as a reminder, if this is the entanglement entropy, then it's equal to just the expectation value of the modular Hamiltonian. You can maybe think of the statement I just made as being an operator correspondence between some area operator in the bulk, and the modular Hamiltonian on sigma, where this only is stated whenever this right-hand side makes any sense, where you have a geometry where you kind of know how to write this down.
Wait, the bulk theory is supposed to be quantum gravity?
Yeah, that's the so I think.
So it's an unknown.
Right, so I think this is a kind of very formal statement that I'm making, and the whole point of this procedure is to back off of this statement and not make it this way. But I think you can sort of think of this as an analytic continuation. These two are equal whenever you know this, and then you define that. You define this as that in the regions where you don't understand what this is.
In fact, we know quantum gravity, and then you can prove it.
The behavior of this area operator is not really well known. It's just like so. No, this is I think a kind of very formal statement. And I'm kind of maybe setting this up as a straw man so that I cannot use it. So people make the statement of subregion-subregion duality, which is kind of this strong statement. But of course, this formula looks very similar to something that existed well before ADS-CFT. There's a kind of thermodynamical version, which is probably better known and where if you have some, horizon with some fields, the kind of thermodynamic entropy that always rises is given by the area of that horizon and the entropy of the fields. This is not a microscopic statement. It's a kind of a thermodynamic statement. A huge amount has been done with this, of course. And so the program that's kind of gotten the name along with somewhere in the past as geometry from entanglement, is to look at this sort of equation in this light. So treating the CFT as the theory that you're studying, go hunt for a set of states that you could call thermodynamic in the sense that they obey an equation like this for some geometry. And then try to figure out what you can learn about that geometry from assuming this equation and as little else as possible. And it turns out you can get quite far by doing that. And so to be a little more concrete, I'm going to first kind of review some things that people have already done. I say that you're looking for a kind of subset of states that behave thermodynamically in some sense, in the sense that they have a good semi-classical dual description. So the first thing we want to do is go hunt for states, or a subset of states. A good starting point is the vacuum. We know that kind of has a good geometric dual. And so if we just do this on some time slice, the entanglement entropy of a ball in the CFT has a universal piece, regardless of the CFT that you're in the vacuum. Where you really only need to know exactly, well, I guess two things about the CFT to know what the answer is. You need to know this in 2D, it's the central charge, or in higher dimensions, it's this A parameter, and you need to know what dimension you're in. And if you know those two things, you can calculate a universal piece of the entanglement entropy in any CFT with no other information you need. And in particular, you can find an auxiliary geometry where we've made really no statement about ADS CFT proper, where the area of the minimal surface in this geometry gives you this entanglement entropy. So there's some ADS metric. That when you go calculate that area with the correct choice of L in terms of A, you get back the entanglement entropy. And the statement here to kind of emphasize is that this CFT doesn't have to be holographic. It can be anything. If it's not holographic, this geometry doesn't calculate other things correctly, but it will still correctly calculate this value of the entanglement entropy in the CFT in the vacuum state. But
for only balls as well.
Yeah, for balls. Sorry. That's I drew a ball, but I didn't emphasize that. That's true. However, just having one state's not very interesting. So to expand our kind of set of states to study this way, you can think about how you form the vacuum state. We can form it by Euclidean evolution. Of some path integral. Where if you evolve for a very long time, the Euclidean evolution suppresses everything but the lowest energy state, you get just out of the vacuum. And of course, well, in CFT, it's convenient to use the CFT symmetries to bring this in so that it's some kind of finite sphere that you're integrating over. If we want an increased set of states that we're studying that are kind of perturbatively near the vacuum, what we can do is modify this path integral evolution by inserting sources somewhere along the integral. And then you can get states of the form like this. Um, But what we really want are density matrices. So to build a density matrix, you just flip this on top of itself. And stitch it together over the complement of the region where you're calculating the density matrix. And so this gives you a density matrix that is perturbatively close to the vacuum. That looks something like, looks something like that, which I'll just define to be rho naught plus delta rho. So the things we're interested in doing is basically calculating as much as possible, assuming an equation that looks like that. In order to get rid of kind of divergences and be able to do things and make use of this perturbation theory, it's convenient to calculate everything vacuum subtracted. So the objects that we're interested in are going to look something like variation of S of rho equal to rho minus S of rho naught. And just as a reminder, we can expand this. We can just write the same thing differently as delta rho k naught, which is the modulo Hamiltonian of a vacuum, minus the relative entropy. Where I'll just write it down for completeness. The relative entropy is given by something like this. There are two things that are kind of useful here to first order. The first is that the relative entropy is a sort of measure of difference between or distinguishability between rho and rho naught that's minimized exactly when rho is equal to rho naught. And so in particular, since there's a minimum there, the first order variation of where rho is perturbed around rho naught is equal to zero. And then the other convenient thing is that the vacuum modular Hamiltonian for a ball is given as a local integral over the stress tensor. Where on the causal diamond of the ball in question, there's a killing field psi or zeta that's what you integrate against or dot into. OK, so given it's a very simple structure like this, I'm going to just quickly kind of conceptually review some of the kind of earlier stuff done in this geometry from entanglement, where you can recover things like the linearized Einstein's equations in the bulk with kind of very few assumptions. So in particular, to linear order, the fact that this is 0 and this is equal to that gives that the first order variation of the relative entropy is just the first order variation of the energy on this ball.
Thank you.
We can use the ADS-CFT dictionary, although we don't actually need it, and I can point that out in a second, to relate this in the bulk. To the variation of the metric out near the boundary, where this should be thought of in some sort of Fefferman-Gram expansion off of the boundary. And the variation of the area at the surface is also in terms of a variation of the metric out there. And then there's an important fact that the details of which I don't think are worth getting into, that both of these can be written as the integral over some form. Such that the derivative of the form goes where this is the equations of motion for gravity in the bulk, and this C is the Killing field on the ADS-Rindler wedge. Zeta is the Killing field on the boundary. Zeta is the Killing field of the boundary, and C is the kind of induced Killing field on the bulk Rindler wedge. Given that this is true, it seems like it's a bit of technical detail to show that it actually exists, but it's believable in some sense that this is the variation of, or the kind of a variation of the metric out here, this is a variation of the metric out here, that there exists essentially via the gravitational equivalent of Gauss's law. Some rule that would say that if the equations of motion hold in between, the whole thing kind of cancels out to zero when there's no sources. And so in particular, if you subtract these two things using this argument, you get something like this. But if you then go and apply the one thing we kind of wanted to assume, which is the RT formula, and this being equal to that, this whole side vanishes, and you get the equations of motion have to hold to linear order.
You mean delta E, right? It's a variational form on the left-hand side.
Yes. This is the first variation. It's only the linearized to first order. That's true.
So this identity didn't use the equations of motion.
Yes.
You keep them there, and you can read.
Right.
Assume the equations of motion hold and derive this, or you can suppose that this thermodynamic thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And in particular, there's very few assumptions used here. Implicitly, when I wrote this down, used the bulk boundary dual of the stress tensor of this, that the CFT stress tensor is equal to kind of the subleading variation of the metric field. But it turns out you don't actually even need that. If you take these spheres to be very, very, very tiny near the boundary, this relationship or the RT formula plus this thing actually gives you something that looks like that. And so it turns out that using just the RT formula and really almost no other assumptions about ADS-CFT at all, you can get something that the geometry that correctly calculates the entanglement entropies in the CFT kind of naturally has to obey the Einstein's equations regardless of ADS-CFT or anything else. So this calculation can be pushed to second order with a significant increase in technical detail, but there's really only two conceptual changes to the result. One is this argument that a sort of gravitational constraint, like Gauss's law, cancels these two if the equations of motion hold. If there are sources in the center here, they cancel only up to the sources. And up to second order, you can have meaningful sources in the bulk. And so this relationship, picks up an extra term. I want to rewrite it. Nah, I'll just add it on here. So now we're at second order. That looks something like the integral of the canonical energy, or the energy calculated along that killing field of the Rindler horizon, of the Rindler wedge. So this is not going to exactly cancel. There's this extra term sitting around. The other thing that's true, that's no longer true at second order, is that the...
Sorry, when you say second order, where are you expanding it? The number of variational derivatives?
So this is kind of, very formally, rho is going to be equal to rho naught plus delta 1 rho plus delta 2 rho. And we're expanding the entanglement entropy is some kind of non-linear function of this. So we're expanding the entanglement entropy to second order in these variations. So it's going to be first order in this variation and second order in that variation.
Here the delta should be delta 2?
Yes.
It's a combination of
delta 1. So this is a... the
left-hand side 2.
Right. So what will happen is that the equations kind of separate. The delta 2 of rho obeys a first order-like equation, and you get the kind of equations of motion here. And then the delta 1 rho squared picks up these new terms that act like this.
Are these words tracking with the powers of lambda, the deformation
parameter? That was the next thing I was going to say here, is that while this is kind of a very formal statement, the ability to actually do calculations, you construct these deltas using, did it get erased? It got erased. But in terms of lambda, and so these track exactly the number of lambdas you have. Yeah. So the second thing that's no longer true is that the second variation of the relative entropy is no longer zero. Or the contribution of the relative entropy is no longer zero. And so when you set the RT formula to be true, it's no longer that this is equal to zero. There is a plus, well, moved it to this side, so there's a minus S2 delta 2S relative in here. And through very careful, detailed contour calculations, you can check that for this class of state, or the class of states where you you source with these lambdas in the Euclidean evolution of the path integral, you can check that this is equal to, or can be written as the same sort of integral over canonical energy. So this cancels and that cancels. And you end up finding that the second order equations of motion also hold. This is kind of magic. It doesn't really look like that this has any relationship to that.
Omega, would you say that a bit more what omega is?
Sorry, what?
What is omega?
Omega is the canonical energy on sigma. So it's going to be something like, I think, there's a symplectic form, and then it's something like delta phi.
The kinetic energy of the matter field, or both?
Both. Plus? It's both the matter. Both. It's kind of It's whatever you source. So if you're sourcing stress tensors and matter fields, it's going to be the canonical energy of both. Yeah.
Sorry, can you? What you were writing was a one form here. but you want to put delta 2.
Yeah, I think I drop here.
That second order, in some sense, in phase space, what you're revealing is a metric structure, right?
Yeah.
Besides the symmetric structure. So that's more like a delta 1 square, and then what you call delta 2 will be re.
That thing
into your delta 1.
The delta 2 means it's there's no contribution from delta 2 rho.
Yeah, there's
It's delta one squared.
It's delta one squared.
Yes.
It's really there's a natural metric structure that you're working on.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
It's because you have a vacuum. So usually
it's because there's a background killing vector. It
right.
sort of lets you turn this into a metric at that point. You're perturbing around a symmetry point. Yeah.
But eventually, that could be more general than that. Right. That is a. The presence of a metric structure is usually with the choice of, you know, Kähler structure of your phase space, which is
yeah.
the choice of a background state.
It gets hard fast, though, because the a lot of these things have been the modular Hamiltonian being transformed into kind of this local integral
I'm thinking of the purely gravitational.
Oh,
phase space. Because I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, I want to say Wald has worked out a lot of this in detail, and I think he has a non-perturbative version of it, but we're not working with that. So I don't, I'm not entirely clear on that, but yeah, everything we do is going to have to be perturbative around the vacuum because it's the only way to make the modular Hamiltonian anything that you have any control over at all. All right. So,
can you remind me what goes into that mapping to the between the relative entropy and like the canonical like, do you just assume that something satisfying a linearized equation of motion, or?
I mean, so you can build this on top of the first order stuff where you don't need any of this. So the linearized equations of motion. You don't even need to assume. They're just kind of, you've already solved for them.
Right,
some, yeah, you've already, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So there's, it's not very illuminating. You can kind of, there's some complicated contour integrals. You can write this thing as kind of an integral over the diamond in the boundary. And then you can evolve it kind of radially inwards. And then you have to find some way to cancel out the bits that appear on the null horizons, and once you've done all of that, what's left is this, and it's just like it takes a lot of work, and I don't find it very illuminating.
If I understand properly, the second variation of the relative entropy is always positive, right?
Yeah.
So it means that the canonical energy also is always positive.
I think so. Yeah. At least in this subclass of states, in this subset of states. And the next statement I'm actually going to make in terms of trying to motivate what we're thinking about.
Is that as a proof of positivity of energy? Is that somehow akin, equivalent to the proof of positivity? Like Wigton proof? Or?
Maybe. This statement is. Right, this statement's limited to kind of, well, classical.
That's never been proven classically, but yeah, it's sort of motivated by this.
The proof is classical.
No, I mean for subregions. This is like a subregion positivity statement.
Yeah, which is surprising, because usually the proof is only, it's more general than the proof of Witten.
Well, it's also a perturbative statement.
Though. Yeah.
This is only perturbations of something with a killing vector. So it's a little bit. But I think the reason this canonical energy was invented, I think, before these sorts of arguments, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
To understand stability of perturbations. So if you have a killing vector, you can you know, build this
thing. It was known that it was a positive quantum.
That's why it was constructed, basically, to have that property.
Is the Brown York energy rule? What is
it? I don't think so. It's defined on sigma. It's something like the symplectic structure of an evolution alongside something like that. So there's some symplectic. So it's a Lie derivative along C. So it's something like phi pi. So I just erased the equation, but we're not this is what I wanted to keep up. In all of this, we're not using the full equation with the full RT conjecture with the kind of correction term. At no point in any of what I've talked about has this meant anything to us. And in fact, the reason is that in coherent states, which is what is constructed by these single trace sources in the CFT in the Euclidean evolution, for coherent state, for free field and coherent states, the entanglement entropy is the same as the vacuum. And so this term is always contributing nothing. And in general, we would like to make use of the full set of equations. Second, this creates a little bit of an illusion because if the entropy is zero, then there's a relationship between the energy in the bulk and the relative entropy in the bulk. And so it's plausible that in this subset of states, the CFT relative entropy, which looks like it very carefully cancels against this, is actually more related to the relative entropy in the bulk. And it's simply our special subset of states that's relating these things to each other. And in particular, if we go back to the kind of top-down view of things, there's an argument by JLMS, or by Jafiris, Lukovic, Maldacena, and so that we actually should expect that for states that are close enough to each other that the geometries are the same. That the that's trivial. The bulk and boundary relative entropies are the same. And so this sort of magical cancellation we see over there is a result of our kind of subset of states. And we'd like to get away from that in order to kind of get a better sense of what's actually happening in an equation like this. So there's a couple ways to do that. Which we will do one. One is you could look more carefully at bulk interactions. This statement's only true for free fields. So if you go to not free fields, you don't have to deal with it anymore. But this sort of violates our doctrine of trying to assume as little about the CFT as possible. You have to start worrying more about detailed calculations when you do something like this, or kind of the detailed interactions in the CFT. Secondly, we can move away from states that are perturbatively close to the vacuum and look instead at states like this, where there's not the vacuum plus a little bit. And in particular, you know, this in the bulk will produce something that looks like that for some scalar field. But this takes away all of our technology of being able to calculate things nice and easily from the kind of perturbatively around the vacuum. And in particular, in ADS3, Nabil Iqbal, Axe Bellin, and Lokand, did a calculation like this and showed that everything cancels like you'd expect it to. It required quite a bit of careful work with Bogoliubov transformations in ADS3. But the cancellations that you get are still kind of miraculous looking. The relative entropy is not clear what's going on. Alternatively, we can simply increase the set of states perturbatively around the vacuum that we're considering. And instead of considering just things sourced by single trace states or single trace sources, increase this to things such as the following. And what we would expect from kind of bi-local double trace sources like this, if these are kind of each a simple single trace operator, is that the bulk dual to this is going to be a squeezed state in the bulk. And that does have non-trivial bulk entropy relative to the vacuum. And so what we're going to try to do is kind of explore this picture of looking at things for things that are sourced this way instead of with a single trace operator. There's a couple other reasons to maybe be interested in this, in that various limits of this way of looking at things become other systems that people are interested in. If you take the Euclidean half circle and push the support of lambda kind of up to the two edges, then you get something that looks kind of similar to the transversible wormholes that people have been studying. Alternatively, if you take it local, and make the operator that you're sourcing T and T bar, you get something like TT bar deformation. So this is a kind of generalized version of a couple systems that people have been interested in.
All right. Can you repeat the main distinction between acting with a single trace or acting with this?
So for our purposes, what's interesting is what you build in the bulk. So in some kind of rough schematic sense, when you put an e to the lambda o in the action, the bulk state looks something like a coherent state where you have a and a daggers up in an exponential. This coherent state in the bulk doesn't have any entanglement entropy to kind of as free fields.
Okay. Coherent from the point of view of like the particle excitations.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas something like this ends up giving states that are not as trivial. You know, they have sort of like two A's in the exponential. That but are they still Gaussian? So you hope that you might actually be able to do a calculation. So the first question we could ask is, what happens at the classical level? I wanted to make one aside about scalings. I'm going to assume that all our single trace operators are normalized with a 1 over n, so that they're essentially order 1. And the sources I'll put in are perturbatively small, but classically perturbatively small. So they scale as n squared, even if they're tiny. And with these sorts of normalizations, we get things like this, if these are all the connected correlators. So the first thing we might ask is what happens classically in the bulk. We're turning on kind of as big of a source as we can turn on. when this bilocal source. And so you might wonder that you end up with, and we know it kind of corresponds to turning on entanglement in the bulk because these squeeze states have entanglement. You might wonder that you can get kind of a classical amount of bulk entanglement with a classical source like this. It turns out you can't. Well, if that was the case, then it would be some sort of modification to the Ryu-Takanagi equation, because you would be getting kind of n squared corrections to the area term. But this doesn't happen. And we can, I guess it's easier to state the result and then work there as opposed to work there first. So if I'm sourcing my action with something like that, it turns out that the order n squared entanglement entropy of a row based on lambda 1 and lambda 2 is equal to that of a different but single trace source that we can figure out at order n squared. And this single trace source can be defined implicitly like the following. So it depends on the one-point function in its own source, but this is an implicit definition of this lambda effective, and the statement is that the entanglement entropies are kind of the same classical. To show this, we can do it pretty straightforward in kind of three steps.
So if you have several operators O, like in TT bar, but there must be a trace of some structure index.
Because
lambda 2 has two index, lambda 1 has only one index. You know, when I say lambda O, it's lambda A or A, right? There's a basis.
If this is T and T bar, each of these have two indices. Generically, lambda 2 could have four.
Then the lambda 2 there should have only one or two.
Oh, that's actually a good point. We had mostly been working with scalar operators, but there'd be... if this has four indices, then you can only contract two in here.
There's one left over because lambda 1 has two.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, you're right.
Okay, so that's...
good point. Thank you.
Okay.
So I had, for some reason, thinking that only had one.
It's just... okay.
Yeah, good. So the first statement...
In TT bar, you only have one lambda, and then you put T or T bar in there.
I guess I've been a little lazy. In writing this down, I kind of assumed that lambda 2 is symmetric. If lambda 2 is not symmetric because O and O and these two O's are different, then you have to symmetrize it. So there's going to be two terms.
The operator covariant is just a combination of metrics and a delta function there, and then you just have T mu nu, T rho sigma. It's fine.
I'm just asking if you have lambda 1 A O A and lambda 2 A V O A O B, then what is the definition of
O A expectation value of O B, and you also have
you have two terms, one where you've stripped off one of them and one where you've stripped off the other,
T plus T bar.
The first thing that's true is that the one-point functions to order n squared with these two different sets of sources are the same. And this can be argued just by kind of looking at the structure of things that you have to sum together to get this one-point function. The value of this one-point function is given by a sum over trees to order n squared, for which this might be one example. So solid lines are correlators between different things, and dotted lines are things that are sourced by lambda 2. So this thing that I've drawn here would have the structure, the operator that you're interested in, three more operators that are two of which are contracted into lambda 1s, one of which is contracted into a lambda 2, which is contracted into two more O's, which is contracted into a lambda 1. That's one term in the perturbative expansion of this thing. And so you want to sum over all trees that look like this. It's important that they're trees. If you add in either a dashed line or a solid line that creates a loop, you're suppressed by another order in n. If I add in a solid line between any two O's, that carries a factor of 1 over n squared directly, and so that's suppressed. If I take any two lambda 1s and replace them with a lambda 2 to create an extra dashed line, I've replaced two n squared scaling sources with this one n squared scaling source, so that's also suppressed. So I only have to sum over trees. This tree structure can be generated recursively by this lambda effective. So if I source each of these nodes connected to the first one with a lambda effective, and then we plug in the definition of lambda effective to each of these and kind of expand, you can expand this to any order by replacing this expectation value over lambda effective with more copies of that expression. You will have this expand to that. And so to order n squared, these two 1-point functions are equal. The second statement that we can say is that the partition functions of the two theories at order n squared are not equal, but there's a relationship between them. And we can get this relationship by demanding, by using the fact that the 1-point functions are related, and by demanding that we can generate the 1-point functions from these partition functions. You can check this expression. You can check that this is right simply by taking this, plugging it in there, and using the chain rule on the derivative of this respect to lambda 1. So it turns out that the partition functions obey something like that.
Sorry, so that equation is exact. You don't have to check anything beyond 1-point functions matching to show.
I don't think so.
It's exact in the large to leading order.
Yeah, leading order in n is key, but yeah. And then finally, we can calculate the entanglement entropy of the theory with lambda 1 and lambda 2 using the replica trick. So this is the n derivative of the partition function of the n-fold cover. Thank you. There are two terms. So what we want to do is show that this is equal to the entanglement entropy for lambda effective. So the thing to do is to take our expression for the partition function and plug it in here. And you get two terms. One is the explicit extra term that comes from this relationship. So that's just going to be partial n on that term over there, something like this. The other term that you get comes from the fact that lambda effective in the n-fold cover is not the same lambda effective as it is in the original system. And that is because we are defining lambda effective by integrals to other sources in the system. And so when the system, or by propagators to other sources in the system, and so when the system is on a different metric, or on a different space, that process is different. And so there's a, when we plug in lnz lambda effective, there's actually a explicit delta lambda effective delta or derivative lambda effective of with respect to n, and that term turns out. Let's see, what's the? It looks something like this. And by plugging in the, is this what I want to know? Lambda effective down here. This is just the one-point function. You can calculate this by just taking the derivative of that. And when you plug in up to a factor of 2 that I messed up, the two terms should cancel. And so what you get is exactly this formula. And so this does a couple things for us. One, it tells us that there are no corrections to the RT surface. Two, it tells us that when we want to go and figure out what's going on in the bulk, we now know what the geometry is. We go find this lambda effective via that definition. And the classical geometry is now just going to be given via all of the things I said in the first half by this by the lambda effective geometry. And there, but you use the lambda effective sources, and then the geometry is given by that and the Euclidean evolution. One thing to point out is that.
So can I
ask? Yeah.
So you know, the usual result is that it will be perturbed by multi-trace deformations at large, and you're just changing the boundary conditions.
Yeah, I was about to say something next.
Is this result that obvious, given that?
It is a generalization of that to non-local multi-trace sources, in a sense. The next thing I was going to say is that there was an argument that I, I guess there's two ways to say it. One is it's a generalization of that to multi-trace to non-local sources. The other is that this isn't purely a CFT statement.
It's not a generalization because it implies statement of changing the boundary conditions applies to.
Oh, right. Okay. I guess there was a, what I was about to write down is that there was a particular expression that I think Witten wrote down. He's the one I think I'm attributing it to correctly, that I believe was just for local sources, but maybe, okay. But.
Well, I don't know what he wrote down, but it's true.
So yeah, if we're doing boundary conditions in ADS CFT, where these are kind of your leading and subleading boundary conditions, there was something that I associate with him that I think is right, that if you source something with omega O like that, then the correct boundary conditions are given by something like this. And if you plug in the fact that this is like O, and this is like lambda, these do, yeah. One other thing we can maybe say if we're willing to wave our hands around is that the same argument you can make for disconnected CFTs. So now what I want to do is take two CFTs that are disconnected and source with a multi-trace term that has 1-0 on one side and 1-0 on the other side. If we attempt to do this, even if we turn on what looks kind of like a classical source, what you get out is that there is no kind of n squared entanglement entropy. And maybe you could think of this as a sort of support for ER equals EPR. We've kind of tried as hard as we wanted, or as hard as we could, to create a state that had n squared entanglement entropy in the fields, and we kind of ran out of degrees of freedom. On the other hand, I could dynamically kind of throw in as much entanglement as I want over a period of time. And so the fact that the state that we're looking for doesn't kind of exist suggests that it all kind of needs to condense into something that handles that entanglement entropy via some sort of geometry or wormhole instead. Like I said, very, very hand-wavy. So very quickly, because I'm running out of time, we can calculate things to the next order in n. And this can be done, or calculate the relative entropy to the next order in n. And I'm going to skip all the steps, but this can be done directly by expanding the modular Hamiltonian in some sort of integral representation. And what you get out for the second order variation looks something like four-point function like this. So we're integrating over the two perturbations. This is some kernel in a integral over flow of the two of the operators in the real modular Hamiltonian direction. So this is kind of flow along that same diamond that I drew a while ago. There's something to point out here. Each of these comes from, there's time ordering symbols in here. So each of these come from sources, so they're kind of automatically time ordered. The path integral time orders them for us. This is a Euclidean time integral or correlator, and so they better be time ordered in the end if this is going to make any sense. You can pick this S, which is a contour integral between the poles of the kernel that it's integrated against, to try to time order this and make it make sense. But you can't always succeed at doing that. In particular, if tau 1 minus tau 2 plus tau 3 minus tau 4 is greater than 2 pi, you will never be able to pick an S that correctly time orders all of this. And the simple reason is that we have a thermal circle that we're integrating around, and if the extent of the two operators is larger than half the size of the circle, there's no way you can fit two of them together so that they're not overlapping somewhere. So this diverges for certain values of the support of lambda in the tau direction. And if you go higher and higher orders in lambda, it gets worse. In particular, if generically there's a support of delta tau in lambda at order n, we need delta tau over n less than 2 pi. So we're trying to fit lots of little things around the thermal circle. So the relative entropy is seeing something like an asymptotic expansion in terms of lambda, the extent of lambda, and the number of lambdas that you're putting in. Just to make the point that this actually is a real effect and that I haven't just made a mistake somewhere, we can go to one limit where you can calculate directly that you have some sort of non-analyticity. Consider the case where I have a C of T. I have one lambda up here and one lambda down here. The first thing I need to do is tell you what this means. If I'm preparing my state by stitching together a lower half to an upper half, it doesn't make a lot of sense to have the lower half coupled to the upper half because I have to build this and build this independently and stitch them together. But what I can do to get a bilocal coupling that connects the lower half to the upper half is have two disconnected CFTs where I'm tracing out the whole second one. And if I couple lambda, if I couple this CFT over to that one and then that back, there's an effective coupling that couples the bottom to the top. So even if this is somewhat unnatural, I can form couplings that kind of go anywhere in the whole tau circle. I need to probably explain something. There's a map from this way of looking at things. I think the Cassini-Huerta-Meyers map that turns the integral, the coordinate that goes kind of around this and comes back to the other side into this thermal circle. So distance around this thing is just distance around the thermal circle. If I go to the limit where I take this really large, I'm essentially going to the limit where the separation between the taus is approaching as large as you can make it. And in the limit that it's the entire CFT, I can actually calculate it directly. Using the replica trick. So when it's the entire CFT, and I have replicas, the calculation just looks something like this. I have many replicas, and they're connected via lambdas around in a circle. The leading order contribution to the kind of nth order, the nth order Rennie, is schematically goes something like. Like this, you have to go all the way around the circle, where this should be kind of thought of as a matrix, where each of these is contracted into the next one in the line. Then when you take the derivative with respect to one, n and set it equal to 1, this gives you an entanglement entropy that is indeed non-analytic in lambda. It goes something like this, where again, this object should sort of be thought of as a matrix log. Where this thing has an index where one, the x that goes that way and the index of the x that goes to the right. And so what we end up with is an actual non-analyticity. And you could suppose that the kind of asymptotic series that we're finding here is a expansion of something non-analytic like this. Okay, I am running out of time. The one other last thing I wanted to say is that this entanglement entropy, to leading order, this four-point function splits into the disconnected pieces. And that part is not zero. The kind of contribution that matters is the one that goes in a circle. So you propagate. You propagate one end of the lambda to the other, and so on and so forth. This is very non-local and is not going to cancel a canonical energy in any way, shape, or form. We're pretty sure. At this stage in things, it's good that I'm out of time because I've also hit the point where we're doing things where I can tell you what we want to do, but not what we've done. At this stage, we've kind of We have the classical geometry. And we've calculated something like the relative entropy in the CFT to the next order in N. What we'd like to do is, now that we have this classical geometry, put on it a quantum state that is essentially a squeezed state in, say, a scalar sources if in O, so something like this, and a coherent state in the gravity source, in the graviton. So it's just going to be a field element to a perturbation to the metric. And then use this state to find something similar to what we were looking for before. Is that the entanglement attribute of your balls? Where we have some piece here that is dependent on the equations of motion, in some sense, in sort of like in a expectation value now. Figuring out what exactly that looks like is something that we've not done yet. But now that we kind of have all the pieces, we can go hunting for something like this. What I think we probably have arguments for that help a lot is that it's probably true that we can find some kind of minimal assumption version of JLMS to show that the relative entropies are equal. And second, expectation values of squeezed states, there's an entire literature for calculating things of squeezed states. So the fact that things are squeezed states suggests that we should actually be able to work all of this out. So still work in progress. I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Going back to the earlier question about how this differs from what Whitman already noticed, here you're not necessarily, it's similar in spirit to what you were saying before about not necessarily assuming idiocy of
D. Yes, yeah, the goal, like, a lot of this, I found one of the hardest parts of this whole procedure is that it's very easy to overassume, and then everything you do is trivial, because, like, the idiocy of T correspondent says all of this already. And so one of the things that we have to be very careful about, and we're still working out, is what exactly we've assumed in some of the statements we've said. But you're right. The first thing that we worked out is actually just a CFT statement. It doesn't really have anything to do with ADS.
It's just a feature of Lagian CFT.
Yeah.
Boy, I mean, it's true. I mean, Whitten's statement is true. I think the thing that's not obvious is that it factors through into the statement about entanglement.
Right.
Yeah, I guess that you could also
state. Yeah, that's true too.
Well, I think Eric's here all week in Office 370, right?
I think so, yes.
Okay, and let's